Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, we look ahead to Pope Benedict's three-day visit to Lebanon, where he'll be bringing a message of peace and reconciliation to the whole Middle Eastern region. And we find out why the recent release of a young Pakistani girl hails a turning point in the protection of Christians and other minorities in the predominantly Muslim nation. On Friday, September 14th, Pope Benedict arrives in Beirut for a three-day pastoral visit, during which he will sign and present to bishops from across the Middle East the concluding document of their 2010 Synod for the region. The Pope is due to touch down in the capital, Beirut, shortly after midday, and then travel north to the small hill town of Harissa, home to the national pilgrimage shrine of Our Lady of Lebanon. There, in the Greek Melkite Basilica dedicated to St. Paul, surrounded by other Christian and Muslim leaders, he'll sign the so-called post-synodal apostolic exhortation before spending the night at the nunciature there. On Saturday, he's scheduled to meet with the Lebanese president and government officials and then lead an encounter with young people from across the region at the Maronite Patriarchate, one of the largest Catholic communities in Lebanon. On Sunday, the Pope celebrates Mass at the city centre waterfront in Beirut before returning to Rome and onto Castel Gandolfo later in the evening. Vatican Radio's Tracy McClure is already in Beirut and will be following these events closely. Just ahead of Pope Benedict's arrival, she met with the Maronite Patriarch Beshara Rai to hear about his expectations for the papal visit.
I think the apostolic exhortation is a gift of divine providence in this difficult moment. It will present a series of challenges confronting the Christians of the region and will propose some solutions and a way to proceed. Muslims are very enthusiastic about the Pope's visit and are convinced the Pope will help bring the dawn of peace to the region. But the real Arab Spring will arrive as a fruit of a Christian Spring, and we can help to achieve this through true communion and witness to love. This is a region torn by conflict and war, and this exhortation will present a new way of presenting positive solutions to the conflict and the political tensions. It is important that the Church speaks a language of peace, of dialogue, and understanding.
Maronite Patriarch Beshara Rai. For a closer look at just how Pope Benedict's message of peace and reconciliation might affect the many different communities in Lebanon today, I spoke with Syrian evangelical pastor Reverend Dr. Riyad Jajour, former General Secretary of the Middle East Council of Churches and current head of the Arab Group for Muslim-Christian Dialogue.
The evangelical churches in Lebanon are in Beirut, and they spread as far as Tripoli in the north, Saida and Nabatayi and Marjayoun in the south. There are several evangelical churches. The main denomination is Presbyterian, and then you have the Congregational, and then you have the other, the Anglican Church, and then you have other churches such as the Baptist and the Church of God and so on. So these churches are spread all over Lebanon, and they all are under the umbrella of what is called the Evangelical Supreme Council of Syria and Lebanon, because this council is the umbrella council for the Protestant Church in Syria and in Lebanon as well. Of course, we don't have, you know, exactly the number of how many people we have in these churches. Our churches have suffered in the past because of the war in the South Lebanon. So most of the people in these churches have either came to Beirut or Sidon, or they have immigrated.
Can I ask you also about the relationship between the Protestant community there in Lebanon and the Catholic Church? How much room do you think there is for improvement in this relationship?
The relationship between the Protestant community and the Catholic churches, it has become very good. It started from the 90s when the Catholic churches joined the Middle East Council of Churches. And when the Catholic churches became the fourth family of the council, their relationship was strengthened, and there are many joint events between some of the Protestant churches and the Catholic churches, and I could say that they have very wonderful relationship, and this is very clear in most of the areas where both churches exist. For example, last week I attended a wedding where in an evangelical church for a Catholic family, and the Catholic priest did the wedding, and he was joined with two other Protestant pastors, and it went so well. So there is very good cooperation. They do usually in the week of prayer for Christian unity get together and have prayer together and have even social events celebrating that week.
So relations are good, you're saying, on the local level. How do the political tensions in Lebanon affect this relationship, affect the search for Christian unity?
Definitely the political situation in Lebanon is unstable, and it is very tense, because even now within the Catholic family itself, you have a friction in politics between those who are along with 14th of March and those who are with 8th of March. So that, you know, you cannot speak about the effect of that on the Protestant community. It has its effects even on the Catholic family and on the other churches as well. So you have already at least two or three groups that differ politically one from each other. And definitely this affects the relationship between the Christian denominations. They are not one as far as politics is concerned, and somehow they differ in that from the Muslim community. While you find the Muslim Sunni community is almost one, and the Shia community is almost one, and the Druze community is almost one when it comes to politics, with very little difference, you know. You come to the Christian one, and you see we are more divided. And I think this is what has affected Lebanon from the time of the 1975 fall up till now. But now it is more clear there is this fragile relationship between members of the Christian community due to political tensions and who is siding with who. And that's very unfortunate.
In this very complex picture that you're describing, what effect do you think Pope Benedict's visit can have on the Christian community there?
Look, I think already we have had the new Maronite Patriarch, Patriarch Bishara Rai, who has launched an initiative to bring the politicians together. But no doubt that the visit of His Holiness Pope Benedict will make a great impact if he can bring the Christian political leadership together so that they are thinking more of what is good for the Christians in Lebanon and for the Christians in the region more than they are thinking of their own political interests. Up till now, we don't see that they are together. And unfortunately, what was done by the Maronite Patriarchate is didn't yield good results, positive ones, that we can say it is bringing the Christian community politically together. Therefore, I would say that, if you allow me to say that, that Pope Benedict has a unique role in bringing these political leadership together and making them think and reflect on what is good at these critical times we are passed through in the Middle East. I mean, look at what's happening in Egypt. Look at what's happening in Yemen and in Syria and so on. It is time for them to have solidarity with each other, because the future of the Christians is at stake. We are not sure whether there will be Christians in this region or not. We are more or less, on the way that the Iraqi Christians have been going through in the past few years, where you witness now the mass immigration of the Iraqi Christians. We were almost 1,200,000. Now we are not more than maybe 400,000 or 500,000. And the same will be true for Syria if it continues. Same will be true for Lebanon as well. Therefore, what's really important that the churches join hands together for Christian unity on one side, and the same is true politically. And I think Pope Benedict has another unique role, because this is the first time he comes to Lebanon. And we knew that there has been some problems with the Islam and Muslims. There will be definitely a warm welcome for His Holiness by the Muslim community. But I think what is important is not only the nice, wonderful meeting, but that such encounters take place between His Holiness, the Holy Father, and the Muslim religious leaders who are active on the grassroots level to clarify some of the issues that have made many people, have problems concerning what has happened, and have true reconciliation. And this visit, whether for the Christians or for the Muslims, it should strengthen the bonds between Christianity and Islam, or between Christians and Muslims, should bring better understanding among each other. It should bring the issue of equal citizenship, whether in Lebanon or in Syria or in Egypt or wherever in the Arab world. And it should strengthen the fact of a mutual respect among religions. These are things that we are looking forward to, that the visit of the Holy Father will give strength to and have its impact on the people more than anything else.
Thanks there to Reverend Dr. Ria Jajour, head of the Arab Group for Muslim-Christian Dialogue. And of course, Tracy McClure will be following very closely all the events on this 3-day pastoral pilgrimage to Lebanon. You can find all the latest news and interviews on our website. The recent release of a young Pakistani girl falsely accused of burning pages of the Quran marks a turning point in the way government leaders may be willing to protect minorities accused under the country's harsh blasphemy laws. That's the view of Father Robert McCulloch, who worked for 34 years in Pakistan before being appointed Procurator General of the Columban Missionaries here in Rome. Father Robert met with Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari earlier this year after receiving an award for services to the country, and he discussed the need to tackle the abuse and misuse of the blasphemy laws. Now he believes statements from Pakistani leaders about the young girl Rimsha shows they are willing to confront fundamentalist threats and offer greater protection to Christians and other minority communities. It's important, Father Robert told me, for those leaders to be supported as they seek to stamp out persecution and restore the inclusive ideology upon which Pakistan was originally founded.
Yeah, first of all, I think the key word to use is discrimination, not persecution. We've got hospitals, schools, parishes, which in a situation of persecution you couldn't have. What we've got with these blasphemy laws is really something that the present government of Pakistan is being left with a heritage of, which they're very uncomfortable with, because they represent a negation of the real founding ideology of the country, which is inclusivism. I mean, the founder of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, on the 15th of August 1947, he said, "Go to your churches, go to your mosques, go to your temples, believe what you like, but be Pakistani." Now, these laws that have come in have really been introduced by a military dictator, Zia-ul-Haq, who was using, he politicized Islam and he Islamicized politics in a way that really rejected the grounding ideology of the country. Now, the government at the present time is presented with the situation of how to deal with the abuse and the misuse of these laws. We've got the very, very tragic case of this little 11-year-old girl suffering from Down syndrome who was falsely accused. Unfortunately, upstanding Muslim witnesses have now come forward and said the accusation against her is totally false and fabricated.
She's been released on bail, hasn't she?
She's been released and she's been moved off in a military helicopter to an unknown place at the present time. And I would say that's certainly for her security.
How strong are the chances she will be completely exonerated?
Well, I had a in correspondence with the Pakistan ambassador to the Holy See this morning, Mohammed Salim, and he said in the process which is going on, it seems that we can hope for her total freedom and her reincorporation back as a totally free person. Unfortunately, we shouldn't even be talking about issues of free or guilty here because the case is so fabricated and fraudulent that there's it doesn't have a leg to stand upon.
Do you think it's marked a turning point, though, the extraordinary international outcry at the obvious injustices?
I believe it has. Back in May 16, after I was significantly awarded as a public statement of by the Pakistan government of the role of the Catholic Church, I and an Irish sister were both awarded the highest civilian award, the Sitar-e-Khairi Azam. After that, on May 16, I was received by the president. And in the points that we discussed, the first one was that he was requested to use his influence to prevent the abuse and the misuse of the blasphemy laws by the police and the judiciary. And I think it's very, very significant in the statements that have come out from the president immediately after this event took place. He spoke of it as a flagrant abuse and misuse of the blasphemy laws, the very terminology that we'd asked him to take on. And as far as I can see, this is the first time that any public statement has come out using this particular terminology from such a high leader in the country.
So you're hopeful there is a slight change in attitudes?
I think there's more than a slight change. What we asked was that he would ensure that if these cases ever came up, they would be taken out of the lowest level of the police in the village and small town level and small town courts are moved into the highest level of the police and judicial process in the province, wherever it would happen. This is exactly what's happened. It's taken it out of the level of corruption, of local pressure, of threat, of fundamentalist reaction, up onto the level of people who can examine exactly the procedural issues involved and the quality of evidence or lack thereof. And this has actually happened. It's certainly been a tragic incident for this little girl, Rimsha, and her family and the 250 Christian families that live in that area, and the sense of threat and shock it sent up and down the country. Nevertheless, I believe that we're on the threshold of a turning point in dealing with these horrible and so unjust blasphemy laws.
It continues to be an incredibly controversial issue. The president makes changes in this at a very high cost, doesn't he?
Well, I think the thing is, we cannot expect that the laws are going to be repealed. If that legislation for that was brought into the National Assembly, as the president so openly said, there'd be riots in the streets and every Christian person, Hindu person, non-Muslim, and building school, church would be threatened. The point is not to repeal the laws, but to directly approach the way in which they're applied. And that's why the direct and clear proposal was to lift it onto the level of the, at what level the police and the judiciary would deal with it. And our request, and it has, we can see it's actually been implemented, it's been lifted onto the highest levels in the province. So that is a major, major step forward. And I think the president, the significant leaders in Pakistan have to be positively supported in the steps that they're making. As you said, rightly said, it is a very, very difficult path that they're walking, but thanks be to God, they are walking the path.
What role then do we have in the West, the churches, for example, in supporting the Pakistani leaders?
I think we simply need to acknowledge that they have called it an abuse and misuse of the laws, that they've used that terminology. The Human Rights Secretariat of the Pakistan People's Party in Pakistan, which is the governing party led by Nafisa Shah, have used that same terminology. They have been outspoken in calling this an abuse and a misuse of the laws, and they need to be applauded, complimented, supported on that. And also to encourage, support this step forward in the implementation of religious freedom and human rights in ensuring that the people who treat any accusation or who deal with any accusation are competent to deal with it.
Rimsha's case, as we said, has become one of the most public faces of Pakistan. Mm. How many other people, though, at grassroots level are caught in similar situations?
I think it's very important to state here that the majority of people against whom blasphemy cases are brought are Muslim, and not just people in the Ahmadiyya sect who are regarded as or categorized as non-Muslim by the Pakistan state and constitution, but the very fact that Muslims are caught in here, accusations made against them by other Muslims, we can understand the level of personal animosity, business opposition, sect against sect, Shia against Sunni, Sunni against Shia. It's a reflection of the complication of the turmoil that's going on within the present fabric of Pakistan society. And I think that's really why we have to support the government as they're trying to step back 30 years, so to speak, and recapture the real ideology of Pakistan, which is so inclusive. It's quite extraordinary. And they want to recapture that, and they need to be supported in recapturing that as they move up into the present and say, this is what it means to be a Pakistani.
And the church has a role in this, in supporting this vision. Do you think the church should be more outspoken there in Pakistan?
I think the church in Pakistan has got to learn to see what has been achieved, to encourage the government in it, to encourage leaders in it. We've got to be careful, unfortunately, in Pakistan that we have some sort of very low-level Christian politicians, not on the highest levels, but all people who would like to be Christian politicians, seizing the opportunity for their own personal ends. Now, that, unfortunately, is becoming identified with the press as the Christian reaction, and it makes a laughing stock of it. But I think our bishops, our leaders, have the ability as Pakistanis to engage in a very, very fruitful dialogue with government figures, not the government, but with people there, and encourage, support, speak along. I think it's very important that we have the continual pressure of, not so much pressure, but intervention of the Vatican, of Episcopal conferences, bishops, human rights commissions of various churches throughout the world, presenting their concern about this whole issue of religious freedom. I think it's very important that the same religious freedom that's extended to Muslims in places like Australia, Italy, the United Kingdom, should be also extended to Christians in Muslim countries.
Against this complex backdrop, you have some very positive news, don't you, about a little example of where families from all the different faiths are working together and being given the ownership of some land.
Yes, there's an extraordinary development that's happened in the southern province of Sindh. And I see it as a very, very important public symbolic gesture made on behalf or made by the governor of Sindh on the 31st of August, Governor Ishrat Uli Bard. To me, these public gestures speak far, far more powerfully in Pakistan than books of words. What happened was the governor and I presided at a ceremony. Well, we not presided, but we actually, at the ceremony, we presented, and I stood in for the Bishop of Hyderabad, who was unable to attend, Bishop Max Rodriguez, in the presenting of certificates of ownership and possession of 4 acres of land and permanent homes to 30 tribal Hindu people, essentially, 29 Hindu, 1 Christian, who'd lost everything during the floods of 2010 and 2011. This is a part of a project of house rebuilding that St. Elizabeth Hospital that I've been connected with in Hyderabad, we've been engaged in. We've built 850 homes so far. But in these last 30, I invited the governor to host the reception in his home, the governor's house, in the Darbar Hall, where all of the official protocol functions take place, and invite these 30 families to come in with other invited guests and present to them the certificates of ownership. It cut across every level of caste, of cultural discrimination, of religious discrimination. Technically, these people, these tribal people from the Pākehā Kauri community, are called and categorized as scheduled caste. In India, they'd probably be called the outcast. But the governor welcomed them with the highest protocol, the highest dignity. Afterwards, a high tea prepared for them in the state reception rooms, where if the governor was receiving a leading politician or dignitary from within the country or from without the country, that's where it was. And the standards, the level of courtesy, of reception, of protocol were exactly the same.
So an unprecedented gesture. It's also
absolutely
invaluable, isn't it, the fact that these people will have permanent homes,
yes.
with sanitation, with
That's
all
right.
the necessary facilities that they haven't had.
Well, probably this is the first time that these people have ever owned property for 3,000 years, because they're descended from the Dravidian people who were pushed to the fringes when the Aryan invasions took place into the subcontinent 3,000 years ago. And these have been the people who've been marginalized and dispossessed and outcasted, put outside a caste because they didn't fit in. The exhilaration and the joy and the happiness in their face, individually, as they came up to receive the document from the governor, to shake his hand, it was extraordinary. Afterwards, I had a meeting with the governor. He came down, sat down in the chair and said, "Father, haven't we done a good work today?"
Do you think it's a drop in the ocean, or do you think it's a beginning of a process of recognition of the need for dignity, even for the most vulnerable members of society?
As I said, these symbolic public gestures are so powerful. And that is one that's taken place. And one just can't underestimate the power of that gesture. I mean, the governor was making a statement of inclusivism. Muhammad Ali Jinnah says, it doesn't matter what caste or creed you belong to, be Pakistani. And given the present situation of fear that Hindu people in the province of Sindh are at the moment enduring, with many of them actually migrating or moving out of the country to India especially, I think that a very powerful statement is made that no, in spite of what fundamentalists are doing, in spite of what is being done in the forced conversion of young Christian and Hindu women, especially Hindu women, to Islam, this is your home.
My thanks there to Father Robert McCulloch, Procurator General of the Columban Missionaries here in Rome.
If you have an Android smartphone, then visit our website and download Vatican Radio's first app. It's free. The application contains an agenda that lets you access text and audio content associated with the Pope's public events, while informing you in real time about papal celebrations broadcast live. A news service provides the latest information on the Church and the world, while a radio section links you to Vatican Radio's 5 audio channels and its 40 different language services. Audio, video, text, news, editorials, live broadcasts, all in a single app. Go to our website at www.radiovaticana.va and click on the icon in the upper right-hand corner. The version for iPhone and iPad is coming soon.
You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.